more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I can't hear myself very well, but that doesn't mean necessarily anything of significance. This is The Personal Wealth Coach. Now I can hear myself. It's always nice to get the technical issues out of the way.
Yes, I was concerned with all the equipment around me and what was wrong. I wasn't hearing things well, and the volume knob on my headset was turned all the way down.
That will do it.
Had
almost
a hammer
every
out
time.
Banging on the board over here. Why isn't it working? And it's all
well,
in my head.
This is The Personal Wealth Coach, and it is a radio program. And if today is Saturday, October 12th, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. Meanwhile, we must do some disclosures and disclaimers. The disclosure is that they've actually got several. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio program, it's also the name of an investment advisory firm that does wealth management based in Salado, Texas, and is registered for regulatory purposes with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Let's see, what else? We advertise, we don't pay for this radio show, but we do advertise on KTEM for the radio show.
Yes.
Okay. I've told you that. KTM doesn't pay us. We don't pay them for the radio show. Let's see. What else do we need to say? Oh, the information we provide on here is information. It's not investment advice, despite the fact that the two guys in here, Jeff and
Jake.
See, you did that really well.
I know how to say my name.
Are the principals of a investment advisory firm. This is not investment advice. This is educational stuff. Stuff is a technical term. You'll have to look that up in the dictionary. An online dictionary, preferably. And let's see. The information we do present in here in their educational efforts has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. We believe they're reliable, but we don't make any guarantees as to our warranties. Warranties, it's important.
So we deem,
as to the completeness or accuracy of the information.
Right. So you've just said that we do and don't do things in terms that most people don't use.
Right.
So we deem things.
We deem.
Yes. When was the last time somebody out there deemed?
Hey, look, I looked up feasance, and I found out not only is there malfeasance, there's misfeasance, and there's disfeasance, and then there's just feasance.
Yeah, and feasance is something that you really want. If everybody was much more feasant,
well,
it would be really cool.
No, actually,
it's just a malfeasance. It's bad feasance.
We do lots of feasance. I mean, every time you do something, apparently it's a feasance.
Yes.
And since we're fee-only investment advisors, we're feasancing all the time.
It sounds like a parasitic condition. Do you have feasance?
But then there's misfeasance, which means you just made a mistake.
Right. Or malfeasance when you did it on purpose.
Then there's disfeasance when you did something that you knew you weren't supposed to do, but nobody got hurt.
Right, and then malfeasance.
Which is kind of like malware, which is bad and can get you in trouble. Malfeasance is illegal.
It can be.
Well, that's by definition.
There's a law against malfeasance?
Yeah. There's lots of laws against malfeasance.
In any way, shape, form?
You got it. By definition.
Mal means it hurts somebody, right?
Well, it means it was intentionally evil. Intentionally bad. You intentionally hurt somebody or hurt something that hurt somebody. So I just thought, I just heard the term malfeasance, and I thought, man, if there's malfeasance, there ought to be feasance. Sure enough, there's lots of feasance, but only lawyers understand it.
The first time I chartered a sailboat with my brother in the Caribbean, we had a sailboat called the Malo, which is very confusing because in Spanish and other Latin-derived languages, that means really bad-o.
Mm-hmm.
But in Hawaii, means really good-o. Mm.
Wiki, wiki.
So, since then, I've had a great deal of, in my word nerdiness, I'm a word nerd, one of my favorite types of words is called a nomonym.
A nomonym?
Nomonym. Yes. It's a word that has two meanings, and the two meanings are each other's opposites.
Oh, yes. I like that.
Like the word sanction.
Yes.
We put sanctions on North Korea, which means that we don't like what they do. But you can,
Sanction an activity,
I
which means you approve of it.
wholeheartedly sanction this activity, which means you approve it. So that's its own opposite by its own definitions. Another one is fast.
Yes.
So you can make something fast to make it not move at all or to make it move very quickly.
Right.
You can fasten your seatbelt to hold it still or fasten and make that fast.
But you, but if you're really riveted to it, you're fascinated.
I would think so. Riveting yourself to something would fasten you there.
Right.
Yes, you would be
And you'd
fa
be fascinated.
That's a different facet.
Favorite facet of fasten?
Fasten and fascinated.
And fast.
Oh boy. Yeah,
We were
so
going really fast, so I had to fasten my seatbelt.
yes. We were going so fast that we had to make ourselves fast to stop.
Right.
Wait a minute.
Makes
So
perfect
yes.
sense.
So I like nomonyms, and malfeasance is a pretty good place to
It
start,
is, it
because
is.
if you were to combine Latin and Hawaiian or other Polynesian
They mean really good
languages,
feasance.
yes.
Which
It would be a little weird.
shows indubitably that the Romans did not colonize the Hawaiian Islands.
That's correct. All right.
Well, this still is the personal wealth coach.
And we do talk about financial things as
We
well
do, and
as
we're going to.
strange word rules.
The stock market is represented by the S&P 500 index, very specifically SPX, rose 0.62% this week. Now, that's kind of fascinating because at one point it was actually up, I think, it was up 1.9%, and then it wound up rising only 0.62%. Probably had they extended the market hours by 30 minutes, the rise would have disappeared. And so why did it rise, or why did it do it? And it's interesting. If you read the journal or you follow the market each day, there's some major something that happens and the market goes up and the market goes down and it's
Usually with
headlines.
breaking news.
And then at the end of the day, well, it was up just over 0.5%. Now, it was interesting because this, I mean, it's kind of a good sign because for the past 3 weeks, it's fallen. And this week, it rose a little bit, which is better than falling a lot, continuing to fall. Because at some point, if it keeps falling, it will trigger people depression and they'll start selling and then we get a bear market or a correction or something. But it was kind of interesting. It was up because of the news, the tweets that that there had been a trade agreement reached between China and the United States, and it started up, and that's why it was up 1.9% at one point. Everybody on the street seems to agree on that, at least that were interviewed by the news media folks. And then the details leaked out, and it turned out that there's really nothing new in the agreement that we hadn't already agreed to earlier and not yet done.
Except that we're not going to put the additional 5% on October 15th
But that
on
hadn't happened
200
yet.
billion. No, it hadn't happened yet. But what's the, so the end result of this meeting is status quo, but not worse.
Right.
That's the end result.
And the Chinese again have promised to buy a bunch of agricultural goods.
Yes,
So
it's
this
the
is the
same promise.
third time they promised to buy. But then they also offered to protect intellectual property. The problem, of course, is they're not going to change their internal laws,
Yeah.
which means that,
Totally aspirational.
yeah, well, we'll look at that.
Yeah, we would like to someday do that, and we'll agree to look at someday possibly doing that.
So I personally wouldn't be at all surprised to find of course, news can come out over the weekend that will change this, but I wouldn't, if it continues, I think the market will probably fall back to where it was earlier in the week. On Monday, because as the details of this
Which,
come out,
yeah.
it's more and more. Well, I hate to use this term because, but it is a very popular term. It's basically a nothing burger.
Which I've never had. And if you'd had a nothing burger, by definition, you didn't have it.
I had one for breakfast this morning.
You had a nothing burger?
I had no hamburger for breakfast, therefore it was a nothing burger.
Well, I talk with my daughter about this. Have you ever had nothing?
Yes.
And can you have more of it?
Yes.
But how much is it?
You can have an infinite amount of nothing without changing anything.
Yes, it's a very difficult thing. So that's where we are. Status quo with the Chinese, which is better than getting worse.
Yes. And so there's some big pluses in it. So the market probably will stay pretty much where it was.
Yeah. We don't expect to have a huge amount of up or down movement based on this. Now, what else has been going on in the big wide world?
What else is lots of things have been going on.
We really haven't touched on the stock trading commission deals.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that a little bit. I did some research on that. I guess you probably did too.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. Do we need to talk about what's happened in the market?
We want to talk about the fact that the price of oil basically was following the market, and the thought that maybe we'd get some additional trade caused it to bump up, and it started bumping back down before the market closed on Friday. So that's pretty standard. We want to get into this a little more, I think, during the program today. But the yield curve inversion disinverted, and it disinverted in a peculiar way.
Does that just mean inverted? It reverted instead of inverted?
I guess it's what it did. The short-term rates came down a little bit. The 90-day T-bill came down a little bit.
And the long-term rates came up a little bit.
The long-term rates came up just a little bit. The long-term rates coming up a little bit is probably not going to stick, because that, too, was based on the idea that we had a deal with China and so the trade war would be over.
Yeah, that's not the case.
So I think that's going
to... Trade war is still continuing. We're still negotiating.
Right, that's probably going to slip down a little bit at the beginning of next week. Now, the interesting thing is happening at the short end, but we'll get into that. So technically, we no longer have a yield curve inversion. I wish I could tell you that meant we weren't, that the bond market is no longer predicting a recession. But when you've gone 6 months, and we have, with a inverted yield curve, it's not at all unusual for the short end interest rates to start falling and uninvert the yield curve. But that doesn't mean that the prediction for a
recession. Yeah, it's already that
away.
Prediction has been triggered, and we'll wait and see if this is the first time since we've been measuring to have something, an inversion last this long without a recession within 18 months.
It's so there's a lot of uncertainty, and I don't think there's any coincidence, by the way, that the announcement of a sort of trade deal came out late Friday. It came out, normally big announcements like that are traditionally timed after the close of the market to allow people to digest the information and work on it over the weekend. And then on Monday, it'll take its effect when the market opens. This one was announced just before the close of the market, relatively speaking, and affected the market pretty dramatically. And that probably was intentional, but we'll see how this works out. It'll be an interesting thing to watch on Monday morning if you're a market watcher. If you're not a market watcher, you'll probably find it intensely boring.
Or terrifying.
So there really not a lot happened in the markets. And that's the whole story. Despite all the ups and down movements, a couple of percent, which is a lot in a week, because if the market's up 2% and you multiply that times 52, whoa!
That's a lot.
But when the market is moving around 0.5% a week.
Just throw this out there. 52, the reason why he said the number 52, that's the number of weeks in a year.
Yeah.
So an annual return, 2% per week multiplied, you suddenly got 104% return for the year. That's not reasonable, but you can tell that it's a large movement in any given week.
So if it goes back down again next week, then we'll know things are just nothing much changed. And we do have a caller on 773-1400. And caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Did you guys put out a newsletter this week?
Yes.
Okay. For some reason, I didn't get it. No big deal. There was an article in the Wall Street about beware debt ratings lower bar. Apparently there's competition for the big three rating system, and I guess a couple of them are getting aggressive, and this is one of the main things that triggered the Great Recession. So what do you guys think of that? Anything to worry about? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, thank you. You want to address that?
Well, which part? The newsletter?
Well, the newsletter I'm going to be checking on while you're doing that, but I'm rather confident it was sent out last night. I got a copy of it.
I didn't see the The story, let me see if I can find it here.
About credit ratings?
August, about credit ratings this last time around. So let me see if I can see what he's talking about. Investors yep. should fear more competition. Okay, so a week ago.
It went out. The newsletter did go out. And caller, I can send you a separate copy if you'd like. Go ahead.
Okay. Let me kind of explain the credit rating market first, because what is credit rating? It's kind of like the credit reporting bureaus. They're an institution that's paid, it's for profit, that's paid to give a rating on how likely they think someone is to repay a debt. In this case, most of these people that they're talking about are companies or governments, small, medium, large governments, either from municipalities up to states and at the national level, and sometimes multinational, so European Union type situations. And the United States is sort of multinational in that we've got 50 states in us. Those states are can all issue their own. So how do they get paid? Well, traditionally, the rating agencies get paid by the entity that they're rating. So if you're, name a large corporation, Exxon. If you're Exxon, and we're not picking on them or
but not Enron.
Not Enron, and they're not around anymore. So if they show up, or they call S&P or Moody's, and they say, please come over here and rate us so that we can get good interest rates on our bonds. So that's who gives the different
we'll
kinds of ratings.
And we'll pay you a whole bunch of money to do that.
Right. So if somebody's ever told you AAA rated or something like that, that's from some rating agency. And I'm not going to get into a great deal of specifics there because I'm just kind of setting the stage.
It's specificity is the word you're looking for.
Yes. Specificity.
Right.
So there is a little bit of an oddity there in that the entity paying the rating agency is the one that wants the better rating. It's a little bit like the person selling the house gets the appraisal done. So they present an appraisal, and quite normally, the mortgage bank for the buyer says, well, we want our own appraisal. Why is that? The appraisal might be done by the same company or a similar company. Why is that? Because who is paying the person influences the results. That's just common knowledge in every industry everywhere. When applied at this greater level, it's no difference there. Who writes the check has an influence on the outcome. Now, a lot of the rating agencies are very, very clear that they're doing it correctly and so on. This is all set up because there's a new rating company in Europe called Kroll, and it's disrupting the credit rating market. So now they're in competition with each other over this business, and you can be in competition by lowering your price and maybe with a little hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, under the table a little bit, making the rating a little bit sweeter. How would you know? I'm not going to fib too much, but you know, we might add a little extra point here, point there to make this look like you've got a better situation than you do. That's the scare. The rating agency regulations are not the same as if you're, for instance, buying and selling something. They're kind of regulated by the insurance companies around them. In the Great Recession leading up to it, there were problems in that the rating agencies, this is completely different problems, so there's some comparisons being made to before the recession. Before the recession, the rating agencies were rating exactly the way they had been for decades. They were just doing it with new instruments. And those new instruments were collateralized debt obligations that were being sold from a commercial bank to an investment bank, and there was a new law that allowed them to do it. Then the rating agencies didn't have a rule book on how to do it. So they messed up pretty thoroughly.
And the investment banks like Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and a lot of others were
gaming the system. They understood how the rating system worked.
Obfuscating.
They were, in other words, they said, here's what the rating agencies are going to look at.
Right.
So we'll package this together to make it look really, really good. In other words, they put a facade on them that made them look like they were a brand new building. And in fact, they were pretty much a rat infested hovel in behind the facade.
Yes.
But
yeah.
They did drive-by ratings, just like they did drive-by ratings on houses.
All right. Well, it looks good to me. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Certainly looks good in all the areas we've been told to look at.
Yeah, looks great. Look at that beautiful thing. Yep, it's a great front view. Oh, man, that's fantastic. Give that one a good one. And that's what's happened. So this calls into question the free market version of a rating agency. This is important, and people ask me about this regularly. I had a pretty good set of questions when you were out of town in Colorado on your credit score and how to get your
credit. On my credit score?
On credit score in general.
Oh, okay.
On your being the universal your, not you.
Not the specific. It's specificity. Again.
Right, exactly. So, who pays for your credit score? And that's an interesting question because most people go, well, it's free. I got it from my credit card, or I got it from fill in the blank financial company that is helping me with
right.
The bank. Banks pay for your credit score.
Right.
Anybody
who's a lender, let's say you went to Dillard's and wanted to get a Dillard's card.
Right.
I presume Dillard's still exists.
I don't know that it does. But it
whatever.
Might.
You
it
went
might.
To... I would say Macy's, but yeah, I think Macy's still
exists.
Yeah,
I think there's Woolworth. We'll use Woolworth. Going to Circuit City and...
Anyway, you go to a store and you want to get one of their cards.
It's a stop at the local Five and Dime.
They pay the credit bureau for your score.
Right. So who influences the score is not you in this case.
It's the people who are lenders.
Right. So if... Instead of the companies paying an agency to come and rate them, it were switched so that the investors paid for it. Well, people at the surface of this say, well, that's an extra expense. The investor don't want to take that. It's no more an extra expense. It is an extra expense, but no more than when you're buying a house, you want a separate appraisal based on you, not on the seller.
Well, there's a little more to it than that.
There is more to it. Yeah, go ahead.
The bank, the investment banks who were selling the mortgage bonds to the public and to pension funds and to insurance companies and whatever, they are, in effect, the lender. They're the people who are borrowing the money, and they were paying for the credit rating on these mortgage bonds. Now, you would think, okay, well, the lender wants to get an accurate picture because – they're loaning money out. Well, actually, what they did, and this is what reversed the situation during the Great Recession and is still a threat, and that is Lehman Brothers, for example, was going to loan a bunch of money to, let's say, Nationwide,
right,
who had loaned a bunch of money to people who lived in doghouses but looked like but they pretend they were mansions in California.
It may have been a very wealthy dog.
Could be. But the point is that there was some malfeasance going on over
right,
there. Okay?
Right, right.
And if somebody had dug too deeply into that credit score thing and all the stuff that was going on, they would have said, no, this really smells like dead rats. They didn't. Why? Well, Lehman Brothers is paying, and they're the person who are lending the money. You would think it was in their best interest to see if there's anything bad in there. But it wasn't. See, if they could get this package of loans – rated AAA.
Then they could sell it to other people.
Right.
And they wouldn't continue to carry the risk of it smelling like rats.
And this is what's called intermediation. And intermediation can be hazardous. It's always hazardous in a market when we go from direct exchange to intermediation. Can I give an example of that?
Yes, I'm sure you can.
When I was a kid, my grandmother would send me on a place I could literally, a path that I walked that crossed some railroad tracks and a couple of streets. And I would go over to a local store, which was just probably a couple hundred yards away from our house. And this local little store had a butcher in the back of it. And the guy was called T-Bone, like most butchers.
Mm-hmm.
And
hey,
he
T-Bone.
Literally was buying cows and pigs from farmers. and he was slaughtering them himself. And it was in, and then we would buy the meat directly from T-Bone. And it was in his best interest not to have any sick cows or pigs.
Right.
It was in his best interest to only sell us fresh meat. It was in it because we knew where it was coming from, and we knew, and if he ever sold bad meat and people got sick, he'd be out of business. Today, when you go to buy meat at the grocery store, it is very nearly impossible to figure out where that meat came from because there are so many intermediaries, intermediation going on. It goes from a wherever it is sold into some place where the animal is butchered, and then it is divided up and goes to someplace else, and then it goes to someplace else, and then it goes to someplace else,
and
it's all intermingled.
When it starts, this is generally a less expensive alternative.
Yes.
So, for instance, with T-Bone, T-Bone didn't have access to a national meat
right.
market. He did not have the ability to buy meat in South Carolina at really low prices
sure.
and ship it whilst maintaining its freshness to where was this, Arkansas or Oklahoma?
It's Oklahoma.
To Oklahoma to then put on his butcher shelves. So,
and he went out of business, by the way, and Piggly Wiggly took over the market.
Because they had this access.
Right.
Well, then the next layer is now we're doing it so much that we've kind of forgotten the reason why we're doing it. And the middlemen start to control the market. The people that are doing the marketplace and the national meat start to slowly take over.
And not only do they take over, eventually they start controlling the prices.
Right.
And which is why prescription drug prices are so high.
Yes.
Because the middlemen control the prices.
Yes. We've got disintermediation on about, I counted one relatively uncomplex pharmaceutical transaction. And I went back through it. And this is something, I cut my teeth in the economics world.
Did it hurt?
It did, very much. I cut my teeth in the economics world, in the formal academic version of it, by deconstructing collateralized mortgage obligations during the Great Recession. So I understand complexity and disintermediation. I applied that to a pharmaceutical transaction that was listed out on the Wall Street Journal of a series of things that took place, and then I just dug into it.
It's called infinite intermediation.
Right. And at the least complex point, those drugs were touched by 17 companies.
I believe that.
Before it came in contact with the patient.
And every one of them's got to extract a profit.
Yeah.
And some of them extract a lot of profit.
So that's not the case everywhere. It could be the same company touching it that many times, which they still have to pay the people that are touching it that many times. Disintermediation can be good, but it's generally for a short period of time. If you can band together with a series of other people doing what you're doing to offer your services to a broader reach, you generally have to hire somebody to be in charge of that. That's a disintermediary.
And eventually it gets outsourced.
Yeah.
And then you have an intermediary.
Right. So when you've got this going on at any layer, it adds complexity to the quality of the outcome. That's a really complicated way of saying that it can lower standards. And that's what the Wall Street Journal, the headline says, investors should fear more competition amongst ratings companies.
Yep.
The arrival of challenger ratings company Kroll in Europe's structured credit seems to confirm that new rivalries loosen credit standards. It's competition. They're getting paid by the people that want to be rated.
Well, you can. The good news is that the FASB, Financial Accounting Standards Board,
yeah.
is pretty strict following the financial crisis of 2008-2009, has become very, very strict with the rating companies in the United States. And
we have to keep an eye on that. A new member was just announced for appointment yesterday to the board, and it was a executive assistant at the State Department. To Donald Trump. Now the person is
at the FASB?
Yeah, going to the FASB. FASB is one of the most coveted positions out there because its starting salary on the board is about $500,000
yeah.
a year.
And there's a very good reason for that.
Kind of top of the line government pay. There's a really good reason for it. the vetting process needs to be just like on the Federal Reserve.
And
these people do not need to have political motivations for doing this.
It's really important that we keep politically motivated people out of those positions, because a person who's politically motivated will try to slant the system to support whoever is in office, whoever wants to get in office, whoever, and that'd be
in essence,
therein we get dangerous.
Warping the banking system to support any given government, any given member
political
of government
party or whatever.
Yeah, so we don't want it in any direction. And I'm not saying that that's happening. I'm just saying it requires us to be vigilant all the time.
It's a story I really wasn't going to talk about today because it's esoteric, but it fits right into what you're talking about.
The rest of the esotericisms that we're talking about?
And it's healthy. You know, it's the reverse of what the Wall Street Journal article was about. We may be fearing increased competition and more people in the accounting standards world. But there's some really good news, and that is that the big accounting firms in the United States, there's actually about three of them that are major in the United States, did significantly more downgrades than upgrades on high-yield bonds. Now, what does that mean? That's pretty esoteric. What has that got to do with the price of eggs in China and the quantity of rusty razor blades in Yugoslavia, which doesn't exist anymore, and there aren't any rusty razor blades?
In Yugoslavia?
Right.
Right.
There's no Yugoslavia and there's no rusty razor blades.
There was an addition to that as well in the eggs in China.
I already said the eggs in China, the price of eggs in China. Now, the price of eggs in China is significant.
Yeah, it is.
It has dropped off dramatically because there's a surfeit.
Yes.
Surfeit.
Because they're not shipping their eggs out.
Right. Anyway, we're weird. The point is that...
Say that again.
It's a strong indicator of where the economy is going when what we used to call junk bonds are now called high yields get more downgrades than upgrades. If the economy is getting better, and what's a junk bond? A junk bond is the equivalent of a credit card bill, a credit card for a corporation. In other words, there's nothing significant. There's nothing really securing the bond. It falls into last place if they go bankrupt, which means you won't get anything.
And the company's not got good records. They are not good at making their payments.
There's something wrong there. It's just like a business like ours. If we wanted to build something onto the building or we wanted to do something major, we wouldn't all haul out our credit cards and charge it at 18% unless we just couldn't get any credit anywhere else. We go to the bank and we get a much lower interest rate. And that way everybody, we pay a lower interest and the bank has very carefully vetted us and said, these guys pay their bills and they've got the financial assets to do so. Well, junk bonds or high yield bonds, anything that's yielding above the normal for AAA rated, or investment grade rated bonds indicate the company is borrowing out on the edge of reality. And during times of economic boom, economic growth in the United States and in the economy or in their specific industry specifically, then companies are willing to lend money, admittedly at a higher interest rate, but lend money to corporations, and people are willing to lend money to corporations and buy the bonds when they're not quite solid, but there's a lot of hope. And that's what high yield bonds are all about. And when the recession comes, they'll turn back into junk bonds. They morph back and forth.
Yeah, nothing's actually changed fundamentally with them, except the name is now, it's popular again to call them junk.
It's a powerful indicator about the general direction of the economy. That's a far lead indicator, the number of upgrades versus downgrades. When you get more upgrades each month when Moody's comes out and rates the high yield, and they say, and they upgrade it, they upgrade it, they upgrade it. The price goes up and the yield goes down. Why do they upgrade it? Because they look at that company and say, whoa, they are going like gangbusters. They got more business than they know what to do with, and they're growing, and it looks like, despite the fact it was a risky loan to begin with, they're going to pay it off. Downgrades means, whoa, wait a minute, they're not doing as much business as we thought they were going to do. They're not in trouble yet, but it looks like they may be headed to trouble.
Did you say it's a danger sign when there's more upgrades?
No, it's a danger sign when there's more downgrades.
Okay.
It's a far lead sign, and it doesn't mean there's going to be a recession. It's just one of the indicators, just like if you have a cough and a little bit of fever, that doesn't mean you have the flu. It means you've got some kind of an infection, an upper respiratory infection. Doesn't mean you have influenza. Doesn't mean you got pneumonia. But it's something to watch, and it could go away after a day, in which case it's no big thing. But if it continue, if you get a lot of signals, like you get a rash and you have a fever and you have a cough and you suddenly feel weak and then you start to throw up, that's generally an indication something is seriously wrong. But it takes all of those symptoms together. And so what we're seeing in the economy right now is a pretty dramatic increase in downgrades. Increase in downgrades. An uptick in downgrades.
The down is up.
Yes, and that means things are upside down.
You got to get up to get down.
Not a particularly good thing. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400.
We've got some commercials to play.
And then we got some other stuff to talk about that I think is important anyway.
Yeah, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call, just like he said, 773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We had the release of the Consumer Price Index, otherwise known reverently as the CPI, for September.
What did it do? Why is it being released? I mean, it had to do something wrong to be.
Well,
you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying.
The Labor Department had to have something to do. I mean, the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
No, if somebody says, well, Jeff's about to get released.
Well, they released it. They opened the gates.
You've got to do something to be, you know.
And it went stampeding out, and nobody could see it.
The CPI was released.
And it was zero.
It was zero. Nothing came out.
Nothing happened.
The release of the CPI was nothing.
They said
why didn't they just say, there's no release this time around because nothing happened?
It's important because it's a net nothing.
It's a net nothing, and net nothings are actually something.
And what was sort of interesting is the price of goods, physical stuff that you go buy, dropped. And the price of services, like going out to eat at a restaurant and getting some services or getting your plumbing done, and things that are domestic services in the United States, rose, and they pretty much canceled each other out.
So this is something that I think a lot of people are experiencing. They see some things going up in price and some things going down in price.
Well, the interesting point is the Federal Reserve has been working really, really hard for some time to try to get the inflation rate up to 2%. And it's year over year compared to 1 year ago, the consumer price index is up 1.7%.
That's pretty close.
But it's not close enough. They want it two or a little better at this point because it's been low. But instead of rising, it's been it's been up and down and up and down, but the trend, if you look at it, is downward. We're heading into a zero inflation environment, which says, well, that's wonderful. Inflation is dead. You know,
people President say, that's Ford, fantastic.
Those of you who are old guys like me can remember when President Ford, you have to remember President Ford first, of course, had this button that he was wearing called WIN, which is whip inflation now. We had double-digit inflation at that point.
This is the founder of Ford Motor, right?
No,
that took place right about the same time period.
This is the
right?
only unelected president in the history of the United States.
Yeah, I know who it is. I'm pulling your leg. I'm acting like you're a lot older than you are.
He was Nixon's vice president. And Nixon? We had a president named Nixon?
Wait a minute. Nixon. Spiro Agnew was his.
Spiro T. Nixon, right. And so we got a caller on 773-1400. On the other side, we'll talk a little more about why 0% inflation is a little scary. Go ahead.
All right, caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. When it's handling business in big, large amounts of money and making different transactions, why is it that all of the presidents that we have had down the line didn't want to make proper business with China, and now that we get Trump in there, he puts his foot down and tells them, look, man, we're not going to play this game no more. That's all I needed to ask you, and I just want to see what you have to say. You have a good day, sir.
Very complicated issue.
I'm not quite sure. Profit.
Let me say something. We have fair exchange with China. They sell stuff, we buy it.
Yeah, let's explain fair. Okay, there are things that are unfair that take place. Okay, let's say a fair transaction and how it can become unfair. This is the problem that we definitely recognize in China. Say you have some nice, new, amazing thing that you want to do. You've invented something and you wish to have it created. And you start looking around the United States and there's just, you can't hire anybody to do it. The one quote that you have, somebody would do it for you, it would make it too expensive for anybody to actually want to buy the thing. So you start shopping around, and say this is a decade ago. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in China, so you check out over in China and you say, I'd like to set up a manufacturing facility here. You're following standards set by these larger American companies that say you're not doing sweatshop stuff, so I can trust that. Well, there's some iffiness on that, but we'll go ahead with this. All right, so I can trust that these people are going to be treated nicely and the price is going to be great and all good. So my initial investment here, say, is $10 million. And we set up the manufacturing facility, start paying the people
in China.
Start paying the people. It's working. It's going along. 5 years into it, the contract pops up due. So far, so good. It's all fair, right? You know what you're getting. They know what they're getting. People are paying each other for transactions. It's all good. 5 years pops up. Your contract is due. You spent the money on the manufacturing facility, but the Chinese law says that you can't bring in foreign people to work in the manufacturing facility. So you have to hire from these companies that are already there. And the companies that are allowed to work there, there's only one company that's allowed to work in this manufacturing facility. That's part of the deal. If we do the same thing in the United States, if a foreign entity wants to set up a manufacturing facility here, they can't constantly be firing companies and rehiring them. We say, all right, stick to this, and you've got a deal. We need to have some obligation from you that you're going to be here for a while and that you're not going to suddenly start messing with our people. Okay. Contract comes due. Now your idea and you are profitable. You're doing well. You've been offering your product for 5 years or a little less. You've been doing it for 4 years because it took you a year to get set up. You're starting to see profits. For the first several years, you didn't see any. You're giving yourself a paycheck. This is fantastic. All right. Now the Chinese company says, in order for us to sign this deal again, otherwise, you're going to have to go somewhere else and set up a new manufacturing facility. You're going to have to trust us with more of your idea. You need to tell us all about it. You need to tell us all of the secret parts of it so that we can make it better for you. You still have a choice. You can say, no, I'm not going to give you that stuff. I'm going somewhere else. But now you're out your initial investment in there. You've spent money on that place already. You've trained up a bunch of people to do what you want them to do. There's a huge sunk cost. And they say, give us your secrets. That's what we talk about when we say forced sharing of intellectual property. It's not really forced. There's not a gun involved. There's just a lot of money involved. So that's a problem. And over a long period of time, it hasn't been a problem. It's only been in the last decade that that's really been picking up that specific type of thing.
Now, you were probably referring to the president's claim that China has been stealing money from us.
Yes.
Because of an imbalance in trade.
That's simply not true.
And that's simple. That is absolutely not true.
It's just a gross misunderstanding of how those numbers are run.
The American people choose to buy things at Walmart or whatever because they're less expensive and they're made in China. So our dollars go to China. China, in turn, loans them back to us, by the way. Financing a chunk of our debt, and it's just dollars are like.
Let me kind of give this a different example. We'll use Walmart again. Have you shopped at Walmart this year?
Yes.
How much money did you spend there?
I don't know.
Just make a rough estimate. $1,000?
Probably.
Okay, so you spent $1,000 at Walmart this year. How much did Walmart buy from you?
Nothing.
They stole from you. No. No, that's not how you're balancing trade here. You're not trying to trade to Walmart. You're trying to trade
now
from Walmart.
I could set it because Walmart does, like Amazon, allow people to sell things on their website. Technically, I could be selling things through or to Walmart.
Right.
But very few people do.
Yeah. So the reality here is the balance of trade isn't about who's taking money from whom. It's Who's trading? That money went to China and we got something in return. We bought something. They didn't just take our money and not give us something.
Now, this has happened before, and if you're not a student of history, you probably don't know about it. But before the Civil War in the 1830s, the New England states were terribly concerned about the movement of factories to the southern states.
Right.
And the movement of manufacturing to the southern states, because the steam engine was making it possible to actually manufacture things where there weren't waterfalls.
Yeah. All the waterfalls are really, really well concentrated in the northeast and the northwest.
And then the northern states got more and more and more upset with the southern states on the eastern seaboard for taking their business away. And there was an imbalance of trade because, for example, the South not only grew cotton, but they were also they grew the cotton and had figured out how to manufacture it and how to make it
into
work.
Textiles. Yeah.
And during the Depression of 1837, they got really good at growing and manufacturing cotton cloth. And the northern states got very, very angry about that. And the tariff of 1833, it's complicated the way it got in effect. But it went into effect and basically said it fundamentally made it illegal. It made it put a tariff on exporting cotton cloth from southern states. It had to be made in northern states to be exported. Now, it's not that simple, but that was the end result of it. And as a result, the South had tariffs imposed on it, pretty steep tariffs imposed on trade on their exports, and had to ship the cotton to the North where it would be manufactured into cloth. It would be sold to England. England would then pay gold for the cotton cloth.
Right.
And the northerners would then pay paper money to the southern planters instead of gold.
Right.
And then a president said the paper money is worthless.
The president being Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson, who's the hero of the current president. And the end result was the southern planters were effectively bankrupt. And it all started with it was exactly the same situation we're seeing today. And it's hard for us to conceive that the original United States and the United States prior to the Civil War was a lot more like a collection of separate nations than it was.
Very much like the European Union, a confederacy.
Right. And the end result was that this led to war. And it was exactly the same thing we're seeing today. Now, the southern states were not stealing from the northern states.
The northern states
were not stealing from the southern states.
Some of them were, but on a general thing, it wasn't happening. Just like for real, there are people in China that literally just steal stuff from the United States.
And
vice versa.
And there's people in the United States, probably we could figure out, who steal things from China. But,
right, but that's not the norm. That's very, very rare instances.
A trade imbalance is not theft. And as Jake said, if it was, then Walmart is stealing from you. But in fact, you get a lot of good stuff.
I have never sold any meat to HEB,
no.
But I have purchased a lot of meat. My trade imbalance with them is really, really nasty.
Yes, right.
So the idea here, what I've just described, what you've just described, is a consumer economy. A consumer economy means that you're being paid for a different thing than the thing you're buying. You've got services, say you're a plumber, an electrician, a doctor, it doesn't matter. You're being paid for those jobs, not for being a butcher or a candlestick maker. And yet you might go and buy meat and candles. If you buy meat and candles, that on a national setting would be considered an imbalance of trade.
So what is it that we trade to China? China gives us goods and services. We trade something to them. It's called dollars.
Yeah.
And we manufacture the dollars. The Federal Reserve.
We also send them a lot of stuff. They buy
They buy from us.
Right.
Yes.
We just buy more from them than they buy from us.
That's why Huawei is in deep pain right now. Huawei is in deep pain because we have cut off a lot of their supply of technical equipment
and
circuit boards and components that are only made in the United States. It's a complicated situation, but the bottom line to it is the concept that a balance of trade is bad, a negative balance of trade is bad.
Or positive, for that matter. It's just a balance of trade. It's a good number to watch.
It is an artifact left over from when gold was money. When gold is money, you only have so much gold. And if you have a negative balance of trade and you're sending more money out than you're bringing in, eventually you run out of gold and you go bankrupt. But we manufacture our own money, and we have the highest quality money in the world. As a matter of fact, your money, the dollar against a trade-weighted basket of world currencies is up 3.28% from last year at this time.
Which is better than the market.
So what we have is a rising value of the dollar, which means that the world says the quality of this thing we call the U.S. dollar is good, and there's a short supply of it. There's lots of evidence that there's a shortage of it. Because there's a shortage of it, the price is rising. We have this extremely valuable commodity, which, by the way, the quality control on is at the Federal Reserve, which is why it needs to stay independent, which is why one of the reasons lowering interest rates to zero would be a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. This is important. With the dollar rising, so the quality of our dollar is being deemed to be better. There may be less of it than we thought. So the price of the dollar is going up, which means that when we go to buy something from another country, our dollars buy more. And when we go to sell something from another country,